Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, today's podcast is our interview with Shannon Thomas.
Shannon Thomas, private practice.
Yes, a social worker from Texas. Good old Texas.
Yeah.
The Lone Star.
The Lone Star Country.
That's right.
They want to be a country.
I lived in Texas
for 7 years.
I know you did.
And they're very proud of that state. If you are a native Texan, you have a very special status in that state.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we interviewed Shannon about her book entitled Healing from Hidden Abuse, right. A Journey Through the Stages of Recovery from Psychological Abuse.
Right.
Now,
the emphasis on psychological abuse.
I was going to say, because one of the really interesting things that I hope listeners will pull from this interview is our discussion or her differentiation between emotional abuse and psychological abuse. I thought that was really interesting.
Right.
But she talks about these stages that she finds her patients working through as they're dealing with working to recover from a history of psychological abuse.
You know, we often talk about physical abuse, sexual abuse, all the obvious abuses. What I really appreciate about her work is that she's talking about the trauma associated with psychological abuse.
Yeah.
And there's a healing, or essentially a grief process, but a healing process that you have to go through to deal with psychological abuse.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you know, she has a great personality.
She does.
The interview was great. I really enjoyed talking with her and just listening to some of the anecdotes and some of the ideas that she had, and you know, the discussion of flying monkeys and
she takes a nice lighthearted approach to a difficult subject.
She does.
It was a fun interview. She's very relaxed, very at ease with the topic, and doesn't take herself too seriously for as important as this work is.
Yeah, which is great. So
so
we hope you enjoy the interview. If you have any questions, links to all of her, well, to her websites are available in the show notes, so you can check her out, follow her work, and contact her if you have questions. And if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, we included a link to her practice as well, just in case you want to seek any support there.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Well worth a look.
Absolutely. So, enjoy the interview. So, yes, again, it's great to talk with you. Where are you located? I know you're Central Time.
Yeah, I'm in South Lake, Texas, so we're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
South Lake, Texas.
Yeah.
You lived in Texas for a while.
You did. What area?
Austin.
Oh, okay.
Keeping Austin weird. Now Austin has a drinking problem, I'm told. I was visiting there, and my son kept saying, yeah, that's the new thing, because they have a number of these microbreweries, craft breweries,
right.
And they have scads of them in Austin. So now the motto, it's gone, keep Austin weird, to Austin has a drinking problem.
So, that's like
Jeff. And Jeff Bezos bought Whole Foods yesterday.
I saw that.
So Whole Foods has changed. Anyway, you're just south of Dallas then.
Yeah, we're kind of west, just sort of west of Dallas, straight out, a little bit northern of Fort Worth.
Okay.
Yeah. Originally from Santa Cruz, California, so being landlocked is really odd.
It's hard, isn't it? That was
it's really hard. Food.
Being from Florida and then moving to Texas, and where's the beach here? You know, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's good to meet you, Shannon.
It's
a pleasure. I'm glad we can do this.
Yeah.
Me too. Sorry it didn't work out last time. I'm glad you guys were able to get the books, and I'm not sure what was going on, but I think just getting them to you was delayed, but I'm glad everyone got them. So.
Yeah, that's great. We've enjoyed going through them, and reading some of the ideas and thoughts and things that you have. So we're really excited to kind of go through it and kind of get into more detail with some of those pieces of it. So. And we'll have a link in the show notes and everything to your book. It's where that people can get it, and so they can absolutely read what we're talking about.
So, super.
Yep.
So, but So your book is called Healing from Hidden Abuse and A Journey Through the Stages of Recovery from Psychological Abuse. And, you know, as psychologists, we and counselors and therapists, you know, we all kind of specialize and focused in different areas. Tell us a little bit about, like, how you got into this area. How did you start working, you know, with trauma and psychological abuse and those kinds of issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I started out my practice working with kids. And so it was just sort of a meeting families and working with children. And then it kind of morphed into seeing more adults. And as I started to do that, I started to notice that there were some relationships, especially, that didn't really fit our traditional, you know, 50-50 ownership model of, you know, everyone brings things into a marriage that causes it to be difficult. I really started to see some marriages and relationships, family relationships and work that were really 80-20 responsibility, 70-30. And so I started doing some research into sort of what was this other dynamic I was seeing. And I read a book by Dr. Les Carter, Enough About You, Let's Talk About Me.
Right.
And it was really, it was really eye-opening that it was like, oh, this is what I've been noticing. And from there, it just really intrigued me, that idea of this hidden psychological games and components that people can play, and they look really good on the outside. You know, it can be that really good billboard living, and yet there's all this damage and trauma, hidden trauma going on. And given my own background and healing and recovery and things and trauma, that I just an area of interest, knowing what, you know, healing is available for folks. And so I just started digging deeper. And as I did, I started to realize that, wow, we have a lot of that in these communities that look really good. And yet there's quite a bit of damage going on behind the scenes. And so it was just sort of unraveling it and noticing that it really fit with the way I look at recovery and counseling and the way my mind works, and kind of like putting the pieces of the puzzle.
Well, that's great. You know, we do a lot of work with, like, here we have the Department of Children and Families and, you know, the Child Protection Team and everything. And, you know, we do a lot of work evaluating some of those parents that are caught in that system and some of the kids caught in that system. And it's interesting because as we were prepping for this, we both were kind of talking about our shock at how, not just how many children are involved in that system, but how many of the parents that we're evaluating and working with, they too were victims of this, you know, the hidden issues of abuse and, you know, psychological and physical trauma. It's much more prevalent than what really the numbers seem to suggest.
Oh, 100% agree. And that's real interesting that that's your background, because I started my social work background with Family and Children Services in California, doing investigations and doing court work. So I think that there's that common thread of there's more to abuse and more to trauma and to the real, you know, tearing down of someone's self-esteem that has nothing to do with bruises or broken bones.
Right.
And
absolutely,
all psychological abuse is there when there is then the physical violence, but we are not dealing with everything else before that. And so it's just working with those families and in those systems. I was a baby social worker, you know, and that's how I cut my teeth. And sitting here now in Southlake is totally different than going out with, you know, law enforcement and looking at homes and looking at kids and making sure people are safe. And, you know, when you meet a lot of parents, that parents love their kids. I mean, I met maybe a handful of really diabolical parents, but for the most part, they were repeating a lot of the psychological games and abuse that were done to them.
Right.
So I think that commonality among us probably really does drive some of this interest in unraveling the systematic psychological piece.
Right. Shannon, I have a quick question. As I was reading your book, you talk about narcissistic and antisocial personality disorders, but you're not limiting the abuse just to people with personality disorders, right?
No, I'm not. The work that I've done in the psychological abuse recovery community does talk a lot about narcissists, sociopaths, psychopaths. But no, it's not limited to those folks who just have that diagnosis at all. I do think, though, that when we see psychological abuse and we see it as a willful game, not coming out of undiagnosed bipolar disorder or not coming out of drug addiction or alcohol addiction, if we see it as a truly willful event, then we have to wonder, would they fit the criteria?
Right. Yeah. Because as I was reading your book, and I agree with you totally. We do a the ACEs program out in California, the one that
the adverse childhood experiences.
And And so we do some work with kids who are neglected. They're not physically abused, but it's the effect of neglect on children, or inadvertent abuse, parents who don't intend to be abusive as those with a personality disorder. So it's an unintentional abuse, but it's still abusive.
Right, right. And I do differentiate that in the book of emotional abuse. I think that when people are not intentional, when I think about psychological abuse, I'm thinking about the intentionality of this is a game, this is entertaining, this is, unless it's that lower level, kind of lower spectrum narcissistic personality that's just kind of like, hey, you're in my way and you're just sort of there and not giving me what I need, not sort of the I'm right. out to entertain myself. Right. But when people are drug addicted or people are dealing with other traumas of their own, I think we really have to limit then the narcissistic diagnosis. We have to be looking at post-traumatic stress or some other things that parents might be operating out of. And that would be more emotionally abusive. They're not intentionally trying to systematically destroy their children.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's fascinating. And the name of the website now has just left me, but there was a big report just a couple of, maybe a month or so ago, of that parent, those parents who were, you know, doing videos of, you know, these events with their kids,
yes.
and they would, yes. you know, were trying to set them up and, you know, terrify them with different things or, you know, say that they're being taken away and recording it and sort of laughing the whole time. And, you know, and so that's what you mean then by psychological abuse, because they're intentionally trying to elicit this traumatic response from the kids as opposed to something that's more unintentional.
Absolutely. I think it's something that, you know, if I'm struggling as a parent with just my own basic stability, and out of that I neglect, and out of that I abuse, and out of that I do those things, that's emotional abuse to me that can be rectified. I'm not sure psychological abusers truly that are diagnosed narcissists or sociopaths change. But I do think that people that have other issues and abuse their children, they are able to get better. They are able to heal and learn good parenting skills and change and grow. And like I said earlier, I only met a handful of parents that I truly thought were diabolical and couldn't ever change.
Right.
Mamas love their babies. You know, dads love their babies. Sometimes we just really don't know what to do or don't know how to do anything better.
Right. Yeah, we're not very good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, we can train and we can heal, and that's the good thing.
Right.
Exactly, exactly. We're working now on creating a model for this agency, one of the DCF type agencies that we work with, about, you know, because they will refer people and for evaluations, and they, you know, they will ask that very generic question
right.
of, you know, can she parent? And it's
right.
like, okay, well, you know, she's been accused of these things, and there's the concern about neglect and abuse and these different issues. And the very generic question of can she parent, you know, that's
yeah, of course she can parent.
It's hard to understand what you mean by can she yeah. parent.
Right. Can she parent well? You know,
right.
let's clarify what parenting is, you know, food, clothing, shelter, transportation, or self-esteem. Are we getting up Maslow's hierarchy of needs a little bit mm-hmm. higher than just the basics of not letting creepy people around? You know, we used to have a category of just funky parenting. We wish we could have, you know, put that in, but sort through mental health, post-traumatic stress, environmental situations, and then we can decide, okay, can people parent or not? And are they psychological abusers? I would never want anyone to have a diagnosis of narcissism or sociopathy if there was possibly something else driving that behavior.
Right. Yeah. True. Hey, Shannon, one other quick question. What drove you to write, and I mean drove you, because we know what it's like writing books. what drove you to write this book?
Yeah, I think within the psychological abuse recovery community that's online, there's quite a kind of subculture of survivors and advocates and things. I felt like there was not a real model of how to recover. And I think some folks have written about it, but I really wanted to put out there what we do in the sessions. You know, how is the roadmap? What does that look like for folks? And we did a research project with TCU I did prior to writing the book. And it was really good out of that research just to kind of see what I had already been seeing in my practice for a while. And so writing it was just to put a model out there that of recovery, and it's hard to find folks who specialize in this area. So I also wanted to put something that people could do within their own communities or with themselves. There's a journal in the back. And so really that was the piece I felt like it was missing within this genre.
Yeah, I like those chapters on the treatment model that right. you're using. Right. Those are really, really helpful. So I hope people are using them.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I definitely want us to spend some time talking about your stages of recovery.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that we hear often is, you know, people tend to judge or gauge or evaluate without really any metric what trauma is. You know, they'll say, well, you know, what do you have to be stressed about? Or, you know, oh, that wasn't that bad. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by trauma? And, you know, does it have to be, you know, quote unquote, whatever severe means, does it have to be severe trauma for it to have a real impact on the person or not? Does it, can it be any type of trauma?
Yeah, I think it's really individual. I have a very organic style, and I, you know, I live in this area, South Lake, Texas, and, you know, you're a social worker and you go to these CEUs and trainings and everyone says, hi, I work, you know, here and I work there. And I'm like, hi, I'm in South Lake and I have a private practice. This is a very high-end area economically, and people laugh in my trainings and they're like, what kind of problems do people have in South Lake? And I find it really offensive, actually, because it's just problems dressed up better and hidden more. And
right.
So trauma to me is whatever elicits a traumatic experience response. That can be anxiety, that can be low self-esteem, that can be depression, that can be any type of thing that, or words or actions that have been done to them that challenge them on a physiological level and also within their own self-esteem. And so it's just there's a high spectrum there, wide spectrum as to what can be considered traumatic. And, you know, I don't really like to put people in the DSM model. I do it if I have to diagnose for treatment and things like that. But for the most part, we're really looking at health. We're wanting to look at moving forward. So when folks are saying, oh, I ran into this person that wasn't my abuser, but they looked like them, and they're now having a post-traumatic kind of reaction, well, that's enough for me to realize, okay, we need to have trauma-informed care because we've got triggers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
A little bit. Yeah. So for, it's really about what's individual.
Right. Right. So it's how it affects that person.
Right.
And I think that's a hugely important point mm-hmm. because, you know, what we say this about a lot of things, but what's traumatic to me may right. not be traumatic to somebody mm-hmm. else, but you know, it just hits me in such a way that it really just has an effect on me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
You bet. And I think it's really a disservice to say, well, that's not severe enough or that's not difficult yeah. enough, because right. we don't really understand capacity. We don't really understand why some people can go through just horrendous life experiences and come out and have found their bootstraps and they're just tougher and stronger and more vibrant because of it. And others go through what we would consider less trauma and they really are impacted by it. We don't really, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of brain scans ideas and other types of testing, but we don't get nature versus nurture quite yet, you know? So it's really about what elicits for them.
Right.
And then we just start right there.
Right. And you're right about the people in our practices who they dress up their trauma so that it looks, or it's less obvious to everybody, yeah. but it's still there, you know?
It is. And I think that's why I'm going to be, I'm going to do a talk with some trauma specialists in our area about the psychological abuse. And that's one of my main questions I ask myself is, what do I want them to know about this? And it's that piece, is that psychological abuse can look really different. And we have to, it's that bone to marrow. We have to figure out what's just normal kind of people challenging each other and right. having a bad day. And right. when does right. it start to become systematic and kind of a pattern, and we're collecting now and things are really starting to come into place.
Right. And I sort of, you know, as you were talking about that, and, you know, this may be a little bit edgy to even say this, but it makes me think of sort of the double-edged sword of stories, of these hugely success stories like Oprah and Maya Angelou and those folks who, you know, certainly went through very, very challenging things and they were able to overcome them and everything.
Right.
And while those stories are fantastic, I think that's sometimes when you get these mm-hmm. scenarios where people with, again, what a lot of folks would consider less traumatic experiences, mm-hmm. and they're struggling and they just right. can't overcome it. And they think, well, you know, Oprah mm-hmm. overcame all of that. And, you know, this person overcame all of that. And I can't even, you know, get past this one little thing. And sometimes it exacerbates the problem just a little bit for that person.
Agreed. And I have a question that I ask everybody is, what is a high quality life for you?
Yes.
For you, given your life capacity, I'm a big believer in capacity and knowing our capacities and not comparing other people's. You know, mine might be this big, somebody else's might be really big, and it just has to be okay because we all have different nervous systems and we all have different, you know, brain development and all types of things that happen and personalities. And so it's really the question is, what is a high quality life for you at this point, given your life story?
Right.
What is growth? What is health? What is vibrancy? That's going to look different for everybody. And I think it needs to be okay that it's different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we were talking about success in one of our earlier podcasts this week, and we were talking about success and that frequently children define success very differently than their parents' success for them. You know, parents have a certain concept of what success looks like, but it may not match the child's version of success.
Right.
Yeah, so we see that a lot out of kids that come out of traumatic homes and toxic homes. And so some of my most favorite clients are those young kind of 18, 19-year-olds that are really on their own trying to find their footing because their parents, you know, were not there to help them.
Right.
And helping them see that they have a great path ahead of them, they just need to find it.
Yeah, absolutely.
What does that look like for them? And for some folks, it's paying their bills on time, paying their rent every month, you know, making sure that their car is registered, making sure that, you know, all the bills are going. Those are beautiful qualities to achieve. I mean, I celebrate them, you know.
Absolutely.
I like this idea of a high, what do you call it, a high quality life?
What is a high quality life
high
for
quality.
You?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. For you specifically.
Right.
And I think that we all have to step back and say, what is that for me?
Right.
You know, and then how do I become grateful and empowered and vibrant within what is my high quality life? That might be something different for someone down the road.
Right. And I think that kind of gets into, well, as we're going into this to talk a little bit about your stages of recovery, you know, that is sort of, you know, certainly reminds me of, you know, as we talk about restoration and maintenance and all, what are we, you know, what do we consider to be success, or what do we consider to be our goal, and how do you know if you've achieved that? But you have the stages of recovery, and I guess as an introduction to that, can you tell us a little bit about where those stages came from, how you developed those different stages?
Right. How'd you decide on those, and how did they evolve?
They kind of just came to me. I mean, it's sort of, they showed up in the office since 2009. You know, it's one of those things that working with folks, as I sat down to think, okay, what would somebody who maybe can't go to counseling, and not as a substitute that the book can do that, but maybe as a guidepost of just sort of, okay, how would they get going into finding recovery? I just thought, okay, how do people start? How do they show up? And they show up a lot of times in despair. You know, those first few sessions are really, really hard because they're blaming themselves. They've internalized all of the, what I consider, brainwashing techniques of a psychological abuser, kind of like cult leaders. And so it's very much deprogramming all of those internal lies that don't fit for them. And so then we get right into education. So folks come in and they blame themselves. They are, you know, entrenched in maybe some mental health issues or some physical issues. You know, we've had hospitalizations for autoimmune issues because of all the stress of the body literally shutting down. That's the extreme. And so right away we start talking about gaslighting. Right away we start talking about all the things I cover in education, because from there then they go, oh, I didn't even know there were terms to these things that this person has been doing to me. I didn't even know that other people experienced the silent treatment to the point of panic attacks. I didn't even know that there's all this out there. This really actually is a thing. Yes, it's very much a thing. It's very much, we can touch it, we can explain it now. And that's the third stage, is the awakening. And then we get into, okay, well, now what? Well, what am I going to do? I have all this education. I understand now that this is a systematic approach to, you know, bringing somebody down. And now we're into boundaries. So am I going to stay in contact with that person, or am I going to do detached contact? And that's a real tough stage for folks. But once they get through that and decide what they're going to do and continue to evaluate that, then they move into restoration. Okay, so now I've set some limits with this situation, this person, this environment. What has been lost? And that's that sort of really rebuilding. And then maintenance is just keeping it all going and healing at a deeper level.
Great.
Hey, Shannon, when they come in, when you say when they present with despair, you don't know ahead of time that this is what's coming in the door. What are you looking for at that first stage?
Yeah, really, really good question. Now I know a little bit more because when I speak to them, they'll say, well, I read your book. I think I'm, you know, dealing with someone who's a personality disordered or a psychological abuser. In the beginning, it was, I've been married for a while. I think I'm really causing a lot of problems in my marriage. Or I'm having anxiety. I can barely go to work, or I'm at work and I'm high functioning and I'm hiding it and I'm going in the bathroom and having a panic attack. So then people would come in originally, especially now, I mean, prior to the book and prior to some of the work, and would sit down and there would be a lot of angst, you know, maybe just some real exhaustion, worn out, you know, a lot of, I've been with somebody who points out all of my faults and I really think they're right because they say this about me and I know those faults to be true. There's always a little bit of truth thrown in with the poison. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot of self-blame. And when I would ask, okay, well, what is their part? Sort of what is it that they think they're doing in the relation, the other person? You know, mm-hmm. what do they take ownership of? Well, not a lot.
Right. Right.
Not mm-hmm. a lot. It's usually kind of me. I'm like all the problem here. I'm like, okay, let's look at that a little bit more. And, you know, and so we kind of just start to unravel the story. Tell me about, you know, read your text. Tell me sort of what's the dialogue like between the two of you. And real quickly, you can start to see the you, and twisting and turning and the manipulation game.
Gotcha. What if they come in and they start talking about their partner being the problem?
Yeah. We listen and we sort of figure out, okay, tell me what they do. Tell me what the pattern is. How do you respond? You know, I'm forensically trained for interviewing. So I think that helps a lot to be able to ask those who, what, where, when, how, why questions and really open questions. And so it's a lot of dissecting because sometimes people will come in and they are the problem. They are the abuser. They are the one, and they're there because they want, you know, a therapist to sort of align that, yes, they're the victim and the other person's, you know, horrible. Right. So a lot of times it's just really interviewing and asking and looking for patterns, and patterns is for me the theme.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right. And so, and you said that they, you know, when they present with despair, and then the next stage, of course, you mentioned was education, and you have these six vocabulary words. You mentioned gaslighting a moment ago, but there's also the smear campaign, flying monkeys, which of course is reminiscent of
Wizard of Oz.
That's right. It was almost an Alice.
I'll do her bidding. Yeah.
And then, of course, the narcissistic offense, intermittent reinforcement, and idealize, devalue, and discard phases. So tell us a little bit about the differences between some of these so that we, you know, you kind of know how you're educating.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting for me as a clinician is those are not terms that we learn, right? So those are not clinical terms. Those are more pop culture terms, but they're terms that non-trained mental health professionals can really relate to. And I think they're very powerful terms because the psychological abuse and the emotional abuse recovery and domestic violence abuse recovery community gets those and they communicate in that way. So it's important. So, you know, smear campaign is that idea that somebody has enough information to twist and turn and to gossip, but it's gossip with a real intent of destruction. It's a gossip with intent of isolation.
Right, right.
And, you know, gaslighting is that idea of denying what is truth. I never said that. You said this. And really twisting those facts. You know, there's that movie from the 1950s where the husband tries to make the wife think she's crazy because the lights are flickering and things are happening. And he's like, I don't see it. And it's truly happening. And it's to the intent of really wanting to get her to doubt herself. And if a psychological abuser can systematically deconstruct somebody's self-esteem and their own trust in themselves, it's a lot of power. It's a whole lot of power. So the gaslighting is one of the favorite tools of an abuser because, boy, if we can start to doubt ourselves, then we're going to go to them because, of course, they're going to set themselves up as the expert, right? Well, you don't need to think. I'll think for you.
Right, right, exactly.
Right. And then are there any others in particular you want me to cover?
No, but I love flying monkeys because that's what we see in school-age children.
Right,
you know, it's the flying monkeys. Everybody else is swirling about you, and, you know, eventually you start, well, it must be true
right.
because everybody's saying that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's one of them, you know, cultural movies that everyone knows. And it's the Wicked Witch, and she sends them off to do her bidding. And in psychological abuse, there's kind of two different flying monkeys. They're the ones that really don't know. They're kind of an emotional, like the abuser has an emotional grenade and pulls the pin and hands it to the flying monkey. And the suspecting flying monkey comes and says, but your parents love you and your parents have done the best they can when they've been systematically torturing this person for decades, you know,
right,
and there
right.
goes, and there goes the grenade, and the flying monkey, the unsuspecting, really had no clue that they are now off, you know, passing the poison of an abuser. Then there's those flying monkeys that know good and well that the abuser is an abuser. They may be like a sub-abuser themselves, and they find the power and they find the control and the covering up for the main abuser to be helpful to them somehow. They're somehow off doing their bidding in some sick kind of relationship that they have with this main abuser. And so there's really two types, the ones that don't know and the ones that know very well.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
We can see that in other situations too, where, you know, people will be covering up for other people and, oh, they're a great person. And you're like, no, and everybody knows they're not. And why are you off selling their, you know, their press release for them?
Right. Shannon, I have to tell you that after reading your book, and it's very serious, of course, but talking to you is wonderful, because when you start talking about hand grenades and flying monkeys, it's just wonderful. Now I know what I like about all this stuff that you write.
Thank you. Thank you. I live in pictures in my head.
It's a wonderful head.
Thank you.
Great stuff.
Mm-hmm. So when you're working with with these individuals and you provide the education so they can identify these different players sort of in their life, the different things that are going on. You mentioned that they then get to the awakening phase. And this is sort of, I suppose, where they begin to recognize and realize what is really happening to them.
Yes. And there's a lot of anger sometimes. There's a lot of swear words that show up sometimes at that point.
Yeah.
I'm like, I've heard it all, so I'm unshockable. I always tell them, don't worry about me. You will not offend me at all.
Right.
So whatever emotions come out, you know, we'll deal with them and we'll work through them. And there's a lot of tears, but mostly there's a lot of how dare this person? There's just an indignation, are you really clearly trying to put me through this. And so it's kind of where people kind of buck up a little bit more. And I like that stage because I'm a little spicy myself and rowdy. And so I think it's good, you know, to get to that place where it's like, no, I am not going to take this anymore. Mm-hmm. But then it's the, okay, now what?
Right.
What are we going to do?
Right.
Are we going to leave this job? Or are we really going to leave this job because my boss is a psychological abuser? Or am I really going to leave this place of worship? Am I going to leave my church? What, or am I going to leave this marriage or my family? And then we really have to look at, okay, how toxic is this environment? Because some environments we just can't work with.
Right.
Just can't.
Right.
And then others we can. Others we can look at, you know, the next stage.
And that's where you're talking about setting up the boundaries. So you're defining your mm-hmm. world through this, the implementation of these boundaries.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I like to call them detached or no contact. No contact is very well known within the psychological abuse recovery community. I call it detached. Some people call it limited, but I prefer detached because limited is about, okay, I'm going to spend an hour and the entire hour I'm going to be in a panic attack. That's not what we want. You know, oh, I'm going to be detached. If I'm going to be at work or I'm going to be in a family setting, I'm going to get in, I'm going to know how to take care of myself, I'm going to put good boundaries. I'm going to be emotionally disconnected in a healthy way, not a disassociative way, but I choose to not give them that power.
Yeah.
And how do I do that? And so I like the detached contact concept.
Right.
But in all cases, though, you're asking the person who has been victimized has to set up the boundaries, because we're not asking the victimizer, the perpetrator, to change.
No, not
right?
at all. No, they're not going to change. I always point to my wall and be like, you might as well talk to the wall about changing, because that's about how far you're going to get.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If somebody is a true psychological abuser, I always use this picture of the fence. You know, the psychological abusers are on one side, folks with stuff to work out, and believe me, we've all had stuff to work out, right? And we get healthier. That those folks will maybe have an awakening of their own and will come to some recovery, you know, 12 steps or rehab or good psychological recovery for themselves or life skills or whatever it is. Those folks change. I believe in change and health and vibrancy, but there's a whole population of people that will not change ever, because what they do works for them.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. It serves a purpose for them, even if it's a subconscious purpose, a subconscious need. It's serving some need for them.
Well, it's all about them.
Right.
So, I mean, what's not to work about that, right?
Right, exactly.
A lot of problems with that.
Now, as you're working through these stages, you know, once you have established some of these boundaries, you know, I sort of conceptualize or think about, you know, you're working with this person and, you know, through these different imageries and analogies and everything, you know, you're working to build these boundaries. And it seems like the next stage, which is restoration, it seems like this is that phase where they're starting to begin their life.
Yes.
Now, however they define their life, they may, you know, what is normal becomes a question. But, you know, they define their life the way in which they want to define their life now, outside of that abusive relationship.
Yes, and I think it's a really powerful taking back stage,
right?
Whether it was childhood abuse, and so we don't have anything to go back to. A lot of times survivors that were in a relationship or in a bad work setting or somewhere else say, I want to get back to who I was. You know, I used to feel vibrant. I used to be, and psychological abusers are drawn towards strengths. They're not drawn towards weaknesses in people, because the strengths originally were kind of like a little sunshine on them too. They could kind of, you know, glob onto it and suck some life out. I think I call them leeches in the book.
Right,
spare a
right.
lot of words, right? You know, yeah. So they're like sucking the life out of this, you know, target. But from childhood abuse, then there's no, I want to get back to, it's, what do I do now? I just need to know who I'm going to be as an adult. What kind of human being do I want to be now? And then start from there. And so it's really about that dreaming stage. It's not a to-do list. It's just, what is missing? What has been sort of ripped apart from my life? And how can I get it back in a very slow, gentle, not put myself on a treadmill kind of way, but putting furniture back in an empty room?
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And that final little analogy, it fits well with restoration, because you're restoring your room. And then once they've reach some level of restoration, or once they have arrived at how they define their normal life to then be, of course, your final stage is maintenance, just working to maintain that, to keep that up.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of times folks will swing back to some of the earlier stages and kind of do a little bit deeper work, you know, a little bit
that makes sense.
Understanding, a little bit richer. That's why I always say in the book, you know, go through it first and then come back around, because I think we can get it at a deeper level. It's like listening to music or watching a movie, you know, you just hear something and see something different another time around. And maintenance is really about keeping out the weeds. It's keeping out about the folks that come along that may want to, you know, be abusers themselves, or it may be adding folks to your life that bring kind of a richness to it. And so maintenance is really a great stage of just enjoying the journey that they've been on.
Right. Shannon, as I was going through these, restoration to me seemed like the most difficult phase to achieve. Has that been your experience? It seemed like it would come and go, like you'd make progress and then the person would slide back, and then you make a little progress and they slide back.
I actually see that in boundaries.
Oh, you do?
Okay.
I do.
Well, that makes sense.
From my perspective, I think restoration actually gets to be kind of exciting for folks. It's like losing weight. I've lost quite a bit of weight over my life. Super great, you know, and so it's enjoyable to get healthier. But I think that's with restoration too, that things start to get better. There's like a momentum that happens, and it just feels sparklier. Boundaries is really tough.
Why are boundaries more difficult?
Yeah, because I think it's that idea of, am I going to stay in the cult or am I not? You know, I mean, just real blunt. I think it's that idea of, what am I going to do now? Now I know. Now I've had an awakening. Now I see, you know, what's been done to me. Am I actually going to now put my head back in the ground almost voluntarily? Where before it was not voluntarily. They were caught.
Okay.
They did not know.
Mm-hmm. Right. It sounds like boundaries is where the change really happens.
Yes.
That's where everything begins to adjust, because, you know, using the wall metaphor or the fence, it's like, as you're building it, the cement is still wet, and so it can be moved. It can be, you know, it's not as stable until it really gets in there and you know, dries and gets solid.
Great picture. That's exactly what it is. And a lot of times people will just go back and forth. And that's one thing about being trauma informed is, and I tell my staff too, the younger therapists that, you know, I have interns, you're going to have clients that one day show up and are getting it, and the window's clear, and they're seeing clear, and then they come back and the window's all muddy, and we got to clean it up again, because that's okay, and that's just the process. It's slow sometimes, but that the boundaries is really tough, because now I know, and now if I choose to stay and not do detached contact, but choose to try to stay in the relationship we had before, now I'm having to go to some level of aware I'm being in denial.
Right.
Where before it was like the maze changed and the game changed, and I didn't know what I was dealing with. I know now, and if I choose not to know, I know that I'm choosing not to know.
No boundaries is
yeah. Okay. Now, one of the things that I work on with my patients, I'm wondering, I've been trying to think about where it would fit in your stages. You know, one of the things I try to help folks with is, you know, when they've been in that traumatic sort of abusive type of relationship. I'm of course, we're really big, and it sounds like you are too, really big on education. You know, what can we learn from this experience? You know, how can we look back to these events, and what can we take from them to inform us in the future? Is it as obvious as it seems that it would be in the education section or in the education stage where you help them identify traits and characteristics and circumstances that help them predict, maybe future problems so that they can avoid them earlier on before they really get enmeshed or really get too involved in a bad situation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. For me, education is typically about that specific relationship. We're trying to get them to understand how this specific relationship is poisonous, how this one is not necessarily all of the things that have been told of them, that they're the fault. Then I want them to really work on boundaries in this specific relationship. When we get into restoration, for me, that's where we start to say, okay, what red flags were there? You know, I feel like it's unfair on some level to go to what did you miss when they were in despair or even education or even awareness? Because of course there are some probably red flags. There are some cons that are con men and con women, because this is both genders, that are really, really good at hiding it.
Right.
More likely than not, in hindsight, I use pebbles. I did a blog on, you know, collecting pebbles. There's probably one pebble that was like, ooh, that was kind of a weird thing. I'll put that over here. And pebbles, and all of a sudden now I have this bag that's really heavy. And that's how psychological abuse works. It's not just a one event and done. It's drip, 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 which is why I have a picture of water dripping on the cover of the book. There's some, you know, meaning behind actually that whole cover. And it's just that dripping of events. And so in restoration is where we go, okay, how do we avoid this again?
Right.
Okay. What would we have maybe seen? I think if we introduce that too soon, it's shame.
Okay. Well, that's good. Because I was worried that I was going to ask that question, and you're going to be like, well, obviously it's in the education section. And so
yeah.
I'm glad that it was.
No, I think it's too soon. I think that's too soon to,
it seems like
to
it
reflect
would
back on what they've done.
Yeah. Seems like it would be, definitely. So,
good.
Well, like we said, the stages are fantastic. And right. I certainly see, having read through your book, I can certainly see where, you know, there's many of these concepts I'm going to bring with me now when I'm working with patients.
Absolutely.
And some of the, whether they're kids or adults, you know, certainly we deal with a lot of teenagers with some of these issues.
Right.
So,
and I think many therapists tend to rush through the stages.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And reading your book really gave me pause to say, wait a minute, just slow down a little bit and make sure you complete a stage. You know, we do it with grief, of course,
right.
All the time. But in these cases, we tend to rush through the phases, assuming that a person is getting it when maybe they're not. And we have to cycle back through and make
Absolutely.
Sure they have it.
They may have gotten it that day, but by the next week, it's lost. It's that sand in the hand. You know, I've got grips of sand.
Sure.
I got it. I get it. Oh, where'd it go? You know, and I think that's that rewiring after being in
right.
brainwashing techniques. And I see a lot of brain.
Right. Because they're going back into battle. As soon as they leave us, they're going back into the war zone.
Right.
And so there's bound to be some erosion because there's this constant, as you say, drip, drip, drip. There's this constant pounding that they're taking. And so there's bound to be some slippage from week to week.
Absolutely. And even if they're not in the relationship still, they cycle back into that old thinking pattern. And many clients say, I get it when I'm in here. Why can't I get it when I leave? When
yes.
I shut the door? And
right.
I say, you will. I must say there's no shame probably 50 times in every session. There's just no shame. There's just, right. this is just what mm-hmm. happened.
So you find the same thing, whether the relationship is extant or whether it's over, they still have to go through. Yeah.
In the beginning, I really do. Until we can concretely attach to those education terms, a lot of people will later on say, you know, it was really hard for me. I thought, well, she just, you know, sees this all the time, and my parent or my spouse or my whatever is a little bit different. And then later on, they go, no, I was just making excuses. And yeah, so it's that looping back into that brainwashing thinking.
Right, okay. Right. Now, I know we're pushing up against some other things that you have scheduled. And so I wanted to make sure that I asked you if there was anything else that you, I mean, we've talked about lots of fantastic things, but if there's anything else that you, you know, would like to share with any of the listeners, you know, certainly referring them to your book because it's fantastic. But anything, any other pearls of wisdom that you'd like to pass on?
Oh, gosh, I think the main thing for, you know, listeners that may be feeling like they've gone through this, it's just they were targeted for their beauty, for their strengths, for their giftings, for the jewels that are in them, whether they're male or female or whatever it may be. But that's why, not that they were weak or that they were targeted because they were an easy target. That's just not appealing to psychological abusers. They don't want the easy target. They want the big target that makes them feel good. And then they want to ruin that target because then that's power.
Right.
So it's just knowing that it's strengths, and from other clinicians, whether it's my work or the work you're doing or whatever it may be, but really educate themselves a little bit more on psychological abuse and how to treat it and trauma-informed care, whether they're therapists who really deal with trauma very much, because what's happening is that clients are going into therapists and they're being re-victimized, not intentionally. We are saying things as right. clinicians that are harming right. people. And we never went into this industry to do that, but we are doing it. And so I really am excited to be on your show and for you guys to have liked the model and to have liked it, because we really need to let a lot more therapists know how to at least identify it, say the right things, and refer people on if this is not their genre.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. Absolutely. So, well, we have really appreciated talking with you. I really yes. appreciate your Love work and your, and all of your writing and everything. How can our listeners follow you? I know we're going to put a link to your practice website on the show notes, but how else can people follow you and see more of your work?
Sure. The quickest way is shannonthomas.com. And from there, it links to the business, it links to the book, it links to some social media. And so, shannonthomas.com is probably the quickest and easiest way to find the work. And then from there to branch out.
Excellent.
Well, fantastic. Well, we'll certainly have that link up. And it has been a pleasure to finally get to talk with you. We've had to schedule and reschedule a couple of times, but we really appreciate your understanding. And it's been a thrill talking with you. And absolutely, if whenever the next book is ready, the next work that you're doing is ready, you know, let us know, because you are always welcome here and to come on and talk more about your work.
Thank you. I really appreciate the work you're doing with families and all the other work you're doing. It's so vital. And I really enjoyed chatting with you guys. And I'm starting another project this summer, so I'll let you know down the road.
Let us know.
Oh, okay.
I will.
I'm excited about that. So
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right. Thanks. You too.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was a great interview. So until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid. Mm-hmm.